1 o'clock having arrived. I'm going to call the Taxes Conference Committee on House File 991 to order. Welcome, Chair Nelson. Good afternoon. And I will have Mr. Peterson take the roll.
Chair Marquardt.
Marquardt present.
Marquardt present. Representative Davids.
Davids present.
Davids present. Representative Herr. Representative Lislegard.
Lislegard present.
Lislegard present. Representative Joachim.
Present.
Joachim present. Chair Nelson.
Present.
Nelson present. Senator Bach. Senator Miller.
Present.
Miller present. Senator Rest. Senator Weber.
Present.
Weber present. Representative Herr. Senator Bach. Senator Rest. You have 7 members present with the quorum, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Peterson. So yesterday we had some very good discussion because the big issue right now is, you know, what does the interim final rule from the U.S. Department of Treasury, what does it mean for our conformity tax items, but also what does it mean for our non-conformity tax items? And so there's a couple of big numbers we really need to know, and one is the revenue reduction or revenue replacement, and that is a number that amount that can be used for federal funding for government services. So the larger that number is, the more room it leaves in the state budget surplus for tax conformity. I mean, that's one way in which you could do that. So that number is important. And then another number, which deals with the offset provisions, is the de minimis threshold. And that's kind of the amount that we can use for non-conformity tax items. So what I have done is we've asked Commissioner Showalter, MMB Commissioner, to be here on Friday to provide those numbers. Now, if they have numbers sooner, I'm sure we'll hear about that. But for sure on Friday, Commissioner Showalter would be here to provide those numbers and hopefully have some concrete numbers. And on Friday, that will be 4 days after we got the 150-page final rule. And I still remember when the CARES funding came out in March of last year, we were still getting questions on guidance and so forth into June and July, 4 months later. So I talked to Commissioner Showalter today. They are doing their best to get those numbers, and they also want them quickly. So we know that timing and how fast we can do this, yet we want to be accurate, but time is of the essence. We know that because the sooner everyone can get to these numbers, and that I think the better and quicker we can get to a resolution on negotiations. So just a little bit about what will, I guess, happen Friday, but know that Commissioner Showalter will be here. So members, with that, we have 5 items. And 2 of those are items that are identical. And I think we will just have staff will go, should have it with you. The first one being section 179 and like-kind exchanges. And so if we could have staff go over that, and I believe this is identical. So Mr. Klayman.
Mr. Chair and members. There should be a document that was provided to the committee that just says Tax Conference Committee Items for Discussion, May 12, 2021.
And
so that's the chart that we're going to be going off of for this discussion today. And so the first item on that chart is Section 179. This is on page 15 of the side-by-side, House Bill Article 2, Section 41. Senate Bill Article 1, Section 7. And there are some page and line numbers on that, too, for the House bill. This was a House file in 1937 in the House, which I believe was a Chair Marquardt's bill. And so this provision, to explain it, what this provision does, I think, in general, it just tightens down Section 179 full conformity that was passed in the fifth special session last year. To get into a little bit more of the details, the provision clarifies that no state Section 179 addition is required for property placed in service before 2020 if that federal deduction is happening for tax years beginning in 2020. And so there was just a small quirk in what happened with that particular provision. And as I mentioned earlier, so Minnesota or the state legislature passed a full Section 179 conformity bill in the fifth special session last year for taxable years beginning in 2020, but only did that for property placed in service in 2020 and thereafter. The issue that came up is that there are carry forwards under federal law that you can take, you know, a few years potentially after that initial property was placed in service. And so those carry forwards could come in as a tax deduction for taxable years after 2020, even though they relate to a deduction for property placed in service prior to 2020. And so technically with the Section 179 provision that was enacted last year, those carryovers would have to be added back. And so what this bill does is it just says you don't have to do that. There are a couple other technical provisions in the bill, ultimately the portion of some ultimately, those carryovers wouldn't have to be added back. And so there'd be a flow through on a taxpayer state return in the amount of the taxpayer's federal Section 179 deduction. So those two amounts would marry up. So, Mr. Chair, that's a brief description of the Section 179 provision.
Mr. Klayman, are the provisions in the House and the Senate identical?
Mr. Chair, and members, yes, I believe they are identical. I don't think, let me just double check that real quick. I believe they are the same. Yes, they're the same.
Okay, Mr. Chair. Very good. Any questions? Thank you, Mr. Klayman, from Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was trying to really quickly look for the on the spreadsheet. What line is that on the spreadsheet? Because I believe there is an associated cost.
There is, Senator Rest.
Or you can, council can just tell me what the cost is if somebody.
Ms. Taplin.
Mr. Chair, members, the Section 179 like-kind exchange provision is on line 156 and 197.
And what is the cost?
It is for the biennium, when you add both the income taxes and the corporate tax lines together in fiscal 22 and 23, the estimated cost is a revenue reduction of $3.8 million in fiscal 22 and 23, and an estimated revenue gain of $2.8 million in fiscal 24 and 25.
So it's almost a wash.
Correct, Senator.
In terms of a $52 billion dollar budget, it's almost a wash between the two. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
That. Thank you. Commissioner Doty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to comment on 179, if I could, and just say that we appreciate that the House and the Senate tax omnibus bills, along with the governor's revised budget, all include this update to conformity with federal Section 179 expensing rules. Section 179 of the Internal Revenue Code allows smaller businesses to deduct up to 100% of the cost of business equipment and assets placed into service. The changes will eliminate the need for additions to Minnesota income, regardless of when the property was placed in service. So, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Commissioner Doty. So this really is a fix from what we passed October of last year when we conformed to the full Section 179 expensing. Senator Nelson, Chair Nelson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to note, this provision did pass off the Senate floor about 2 months ago as part of our full conformity with PPP and that bipartisan conformity with the unemployment insurance non-taxation. So this is well received in the Senate and has already been passed. And so I'm glad to see a belt and suspenders. We've got it here too.
Very good. Thank you. Seeing no further discussion, we will move to item number two, which I think is also another identical area. Provisions, restore the K-12 fundraising sales tax exemption. Mr. Klayman.
Mr. Chair,
that's correct. Ms. Hagler.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm leaving my camera off today because of my internet issues, so just let me know if it becomes too spotty. So the second item on the list today is found on page 18 of the side-by-side House Article 4, Section 2, and Senate Article 3, Section 3. They are identical in both bills, and this provision kind of restores an exemption that was currently in place prior to a change made in the 2019 education bill. It seems that it was an inadvertent mistake. So this is just correcting what was done 2 years ago. So this provision exempts the sales made by student-associated student groups when the money is recorded as part of school district revenue, so long as the sales are for fundraising purposes for elementary or secondary student organizations for sports, arts, and other extracurricular activities. And also that the school district reserves all of the revenue to fund those activities. And as I said, the provisions are identical in the Senate and the House, and it was also part of the governor's bill this year as well.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a brief bit of history and then a question, although I'm not sure who might be able to provide the answer. So we'll see who volunteers to answer the question. But actually in 2019, the law as it currently is that we realize has some unintended consequences actually was the governor's provision. And it was because of, we were told some requirements to conform with the GASB rules. And so my question is, I'm all, and this is included, obviously, as you said, in the Senate bill, just as it is in the House bill. But I do have to do my due diligence here and ask, I don't believe the GASB rules changed, but I'm assuming those federal accounting rules, but I'm assuming that there must be some new information, or why is it that, and I basically just want to be assured that yes, indeed, we can revert to the language that was pre-2019, but what is the issue that is allowing us to change the language back to the way it was this year, and 2 years ago, we were required to change it to this language?
So
who might be able to answer that?
Ms. Hagler, Ms. Pollack, or well, Commissioner Doty raised his hand. So let's, Commissioner Doty.
Trying to get myself off mute. Sorry about that. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Nelson, I believe the issue is where those funds are deposited within the school district with the school district treasurer. And I think the idea of no longer having them deposited with the district and having that separated from the rest of the funds from the district, I do believe then is where we are. And I think what the change would be. But there are now there would be no issues at all.
Chair Nelson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, thank you so much. So it's not exactly reverting to the 2019 language. It's actually rather than adopting the first provision that the governor put forth in 219, this is a better way to do it. Thank you. I just want to make sure I understood that correctly. All right. Thank you so much for confirming that.
Thank you. Anyone else have any comments on our second item? Ms. Hagler, thank you. We're going to move to number 3E, sales tax exemption for nonprofits and prepared food. Ms. Hagler.
Mr. Chair and members, this provision is in the House bill, spans pages 18 and 19 of the side-by-side. And this exemption would allow nonprofit organizations to purchase prepared food when the food is purchased under a contract to fulfill a charitable mission of that organization. And so currently, prepared food is a taxable item when sold to nonprofits or just anybody purchasing the item. So this would give them the sales tax exemption for food purchase to fulfill their charitable missions. And this is a House provision only. And I believe it was heard in the House and it was put forward by Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Ms. Hagler. So we have one testifier who can talk a little bit more about the need for this. So Matt Norris, welcome to the committee. If you would please state your name and provide your testimony.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the conference committee. I'm Matt Norris, and I'm the policy director at YouthPrize. I appreciate the opportunity to come before you this afternoon to offer brief testimony on this important provision in the House's Omnibus Tax Bill. I'd like to start by explaining a little bit about the role that nonprofit sponsors like YouthPrize play in the nutrition ecosystem. Research shows that providing nutritious meals and snacks as part of out-of-school time programming has a lot of benefits. Better learning and a stronger sense of community among many others. That's why many youth programming providers want to utilize the two federal meals programs you see referenced in the bill, the Child and Adult Care Food Program, or CACFP, for after-school programs during the school year, and the Summer Food Service Program, also known as FSSFSP, for summer activities. However, a lot of small community centers, libraries, youth-serving organizations, and houses of worship that offer youth programming simply don't have the capacity to manage the complex paperwork and the logistics involved with administering this federal program. So that's where nonprofit sponsors like YouthPrize come in. We can work across multiple sites to manage the paperwork and the logistics at scale, obtaining efficiencies in service delivery while also ensuring compliance with the maze of program rules. With YouthPrize taking on working with the caterer and handling the administrative aspects, all that the community center, library, or other site has to do is simply receive the meals each day and serve them to the students in attendance, allowing them to do what they do best, offer high quality youth programming. Serving as a sponsor of these meals programs is difficult, time-consuming, and expensive work. And it's made even more challenging by the fact that we have to pay sales tax on every meal that we serve. The cost of the meal itself gets reimbursed by the federal government, but we have to go out separately and fundraise to pay the sales tax. My understanding is that the original intent of this law was to prevent food purchased by nonprofits for lavish galas from being tax exempt. But the unintended consequence is that it also hurts organizations like ours who are trying to buy prepared food for use in the federal meals program. That's why we're proposing this narrow sales tax exemption for nonprofits that purchase prepared food specifically for use in the federal meals program. Last year, we scaled up to meet the surge in demand for meal assistance caused by the pandemic. And for a frame of reference, it took us 5 years to reach 1 million meals served in January 2020. It only took us 10 more months to reach 2 million meals served in October. As a result, we paid nearly $250,000 in sales tax last year. To put that into context, it's the equivalent of 72,470 lunches or suppers, 119,050 breakfasts, or 263,150 snacks. That's money that could otherwise go to serving more sites as we continue to expand outside the metro area or upgrade aging equipment at existing sites. This is one of those common sense provisions that has bipartisan support, and a joint letter of support from many of the leading companies and organizations in the nutrition field in our state has been posted to the committee website. To close, I urge the committee to adopt this provision as part of its conference report. It's a provision with relatively small cost but big impact to fix an unintended consequence of Minnesota's tax laws. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Norris. And the cost is would be $1.8 million for 2223 and $1.96 million in 2425. Members, any questions for Mr. Norris or just general comments or for staff? All right, I don't see any. Mr. Norris, thank you for your testimony today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We'll move to number four on the agenda, the stillborn tax credit eligibility criteria modified. Mr. Clayman.
Mr. Chair and members, these provisions do not have a comparable provision in the Senate. But you can find the House provisions on page 14 of the side-by-side. That's Article 2, Section 29 and 30. And this provision was House File 118 when it was heard in the House, and that was a Representative Hertaw's bill. These provisions modify and clarify the eligibility and documentation requirements for the credit for parents of stillborn children. Section 29 would eliminate the dependent test for the credit. And this requires the credit to be taken based on who would have qualified to claim the stillborn child as a dependent had the child survived. In place of this test, the provisions would provide that an eligible individual, quote unquote, may take the credit. And that's defined in the next section, that's section 30. And what section 30 would do is require that for an individual to be eligible for the credit, to be an eligible individual, that is, for purposes of Section 29, that individual must be a Minnesota resident and must also meet one of three further eligibility requirements. And these typically relate to the documentation requirements that are needed to claim the credit. The first one is that the individual must have given birth and also be listed as a parent on the certificate of birth. Or if the individual that gave birth is not listed on a certificate of birth, then the individual must be listed as the first parent on the birth certificate. So again, that's the second scenario under which a Minnesota resident could be eligible for the credit. Or for a stillbirth that occurred outside Minnesota for which no certificate was issued, then for those individuals, the default would be the individual who gave birth. So in other words, to be an eligible individual, in that last scenario, the individual who gave birth could just be eligible for the credit. This clarifies a number of documentation requirements that have come up over the years with this credit. Lastly, the provision would be retroactive to tax years beginning in 2016, and that was the original effective date of the credit when it was first enacted.
Thank you, Mr. Clayman. Senator Rest.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I'm very pleased to see this bill has been included in your omnibus. The original legislation was mine, and it was authored in the House by former Representative Roz Peterson. You may recall, I believe you probably served with her as well. And a number of the definitions in the first couple of years after we passed it, they were very problematic. And there was a lot of discussion about who actually should be eligible. And we had a lot of scenarios that were brought up as examples of making of decision points with regard to who was going to be able to claim the stillbirth credit, including things like some parents of stillborn children wanted a birth certificate that looked like the birth certificate of their live birth children, and the Department of Health had a real problem with that, and we didn't include it. but I see that for this section, a certificate of birth is defined as a stillbirth certificate and not as the regular birth certificate that's provided by the Department of Health. And I don't know what the testimony was in your committee. I think it's very handable, or it can be dealt with easily by the Department of Revenue. But I just wonder if there were any hesitancy on the part of the Department of Health when this bill was heard in the House, or if they were okay with all of these changes.
Senator Rest, I do not remember any testimony from the Department of Health when this bill was brought forward.
In the past, I'll just say there definitely was, and there were concerns raised, but if they have worked it all out, then I'm very happy to support these changes. And I can't tell you, when we were working with the advocates for this, how much it meant to these parents of stillborn children to have the to have their experiences recognized, even though their children had not taken even a single breath. If they had taken even a single breath, they would have been covered in so many other ways, with help with the tax system, with their insurance, and so on. So we worked really hard on this in 2016, and any number of families have been able to have some comfort with the support of legislation like this. And I appreciate that you're expanding it a bit, redefining it a bit, and I hope at the appropriate time, since the cost is negligible, that the Senate would accept your provisions. It's Senator Osmek's bill in the Senate. And anyway, I just thank you for it. And I, for one, would support it.
Senator Rest, thanks so much for your original work on the bill. Oh, so.
It's my honor.
Thank you. Commissioner Doty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I do want to say that in reference to Senator Rest's concern about the Department of Health and how they feel about this provision, we have spoken with the Department of Health and they are okay with these elements. So just want to make sure you know that, Senator Rest, as well. But I just wanted to say that we appreciate the update to the Parents of Stillborn Children credit. The credit was first enacted in 2016 and is claimed by a relatively small number of Minnesotans. Approximately 200 returns claimed this credit in 2018. As with any new expenditure, the department has gained experience over the years with administering the credit and working with taxpayers experiencing this very difficult situation. We agree that these changes and clarifications will help the credit be applied as intended. We have a recommendation to modify the effective date of the provision to align with the statute of limitations for claiming the credit. We can work with staff to make sure that these changes are properly included. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Chair Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Commissioner Doty, for the further explanation that the Department of Health is fine with this, and I thank Senator Rest for her earlier work on this. I know these are really difficult. It's a very difficult situation for parents, heart-wrenching, actually. And my question, though, is one to, I'm not sure what is meant by including for situations where the individual who gave birth is not listed as the parent. And I'm just needing I may have some ideas, but I just, that phrase needs just a little bit further explanation. So if the appropriate counsel might be able to provide a little bit of insight into that, please.
Mr. Clayman.
Sure, Mr. Chair and Chair Nelson. So that would be a situation where you may have an agreement between individuals where the people who will be listed on the birth certificate are not the person who gave birth. And just to be clear, this would be situations that would encompass things like surrogacy. Mm-hmm. And so that would be the type of situation that language is aiming at.
Mr. Chair.
Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Clinton. That was my thought, that it must have something to do with surrogacy. Is there any other place where that would be? I mean, that's the only other application I can think of this language. Is there any other application of the including for a parent or someone giving birth who's not the parent besides surrogacy? Is there any other application for that?
Mr. Clayman.
Mr. Chair and Chair Nelson, I can't think of any other situation that would be encompassed by that. I don't think that there would be any other situation that would arise where that would happen.
Thank you.
Sure.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a further comment then. Why aren't we just using the word surrogacy? Why don't we just make the language very clear?
Mr. Clayman.
Mr. Chair and Chair Nelson. That's kind of a tough question to answer because it sort of gets into decisions about how the language was constructed. I think there's a specificity to doing it this way that is useful when the tax is administered. The other thing is that, you know, state law doesn't address surrogacy with, you know, statutorily. It's not necessarily illegal because I guess there have been some mm-hmm. Lawyers have found ways to actually enforce some of these agreements, but it's also not regulated, or there's not a section of law that exists creating it either. So I think that's the best answer I can provide at this point in time, although there may be other members that can provide other answers.
Yeah, and I'm wondering, Mr. Clayman, Chair Nelson, if this isn't something the Minnesota Department of Health might, I don't remember if they had input on that part of the language or not, but Chair mm-hmm. Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I will touch base with the Department of Health. I do remember some surrogacy bills from several years ago. I guess I'm not clear on what our current laws are regarding that, but I will check with the Department of Health. But I can definitely understand the challenges and the needs and the difficult situation this is for parents. So I definitely appreciate the discussion today, and we'll look for just a little bit of greater clarity on the wording particularly. Thank you.
Very good. Senator Rest.
Thank you. I may appreciate the comments of Mr. Clayman. This issue was one that we have wrestled with over the years since the stillbirth credit was passed, and using this language as opposed to referring to a surrogate, there was discussion about whether if we put the word surrogacy in the law, whether somehow that was opening the possibility of litigation that would cause surrogacy to be regulated and to be legal. And as Mr. Clayman said, it's not that it's illegal, it's just not a part of Minnesota statutes. And so this language As at first, of course, it wasn't, you had to be the birth parent, but that this language did not open a floodgate of litigation to have surrogacy, commercial or otherwise, to be covered under Minnesota statutes as that entry point, and that those persons and those groups and those parents who are who promote the legal status of surrogacy have not pushed this particular part of the law as the basis on which they want to pursue it. And Senator Nelson mentioned other other bills dealing with surrogacy that have come up in the past, and this one has been left alone as a rationale for doing that. And the language about you don't have to be the quote the birth parent or the person giving birth was left alone for that very reason, that that kind of ambiguity is preferable rather than opening a whole new area of law that the proponents of the stillbirth credit had no intention of doing whatsoever, nor people who either oppose or who support surrogacy had any intention of doing otherwise. So I appreciate Representative Hertaus' language and Senator Osmeth, and I hope that we leave it alone. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, thank you, Senator Reston. I know Representative Hertaus has worked on this bill for a couple years, and one of the initial reasons why he looked at these changes was along border states where you had a woman that the hospital in the neighboring state was closer, and the stillbirth occurred in the state outside Minnesota, yet you had a Minnesota resident.
And that state, one of the issue too was then in some of those states, and I don't know whether it was like North Dakota or South Dakota, unlike Minnesota, where the Department of Health issues a stillbirth certificate, some states don't do that. And so that was also an issue that just didn't seem to be fair. And so I really like the work that he's continued to do on this, and that we recognize it's so rare, but yet it's such a heartbreaking experience for families. Yet once again, as I mentioned before, that it seems the least we can do is support them as they deal with the costs of their experience. So I hope we'll leave it alone. I think we made some progress here, and I'm happy that we that you included it in your bill.
Senator Bach.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, I remember when we did this stillborn credit. I was the leader of the Senate at the time, and I can remember being up
yes,
in
you were.
My office, and Senator Rest, was Representative Pepin the House author of it?
No, as I mentioned, it was Representative Ross Peterson, but I worked with Representative Pepin and also Representative Dowd so that we got the language right that satisfied the goals of the bill and that gave comfort to the families that were advocating for it.
Yeah, I remember Mr. Chairman, up in my office, I just remember it was one of those moments you remember. I remember Representative Pepin being very emotional about this.
Yes, she was.
Wanting this to be in the bill. So,
she was a very strong supporter of it.
I'm happy it's helping some people. I know people who had to go through this in their life, and it's pretty little insignificant thing we can do in the context of the state budget.
Thank you. Any other comments on this provision? Very good. Let's move to the fifth and final provision on the agenda today, student loan tax credit refundable and marriage credit change. Mr. Williams.
Chair Markwart and members, the student loan credit provision is on page 13 of your side-by-side. It's in Article 2, Section 28 of the House bill. There's no comparable Senate provision. As Chair Markwart mentioned, there's sort of two pieces to this. One of the pieces is that the credit that's currently allowed for student loan payments is non-refundable. So the House bill that session would make the credit refundable. So if taxpayers' credit exceeded their tax liability, the difference would be issued to the taxpayer as a refund. The second change relates to sort of a unique marriage penalty that exists in the student loan credit. It's a little bit different than sort of a typical marriage penalty that might exist in other credits because when filing for the student loan credit, taxpayers are taxpayers who file a joint return who are married, they're allowed to claim a student loan credit for each spouse. However, in the calculation for each spouse, the joint income is used. So even though the sort of student loan payments for one individual are put towards the calculation, the income for both combined individuals, their combined adjusted gross income is put forward. Or used for the purposes of that calculation of the phase out. And so the House provision, it would instead of using their total adjusted gross income for the purposes of calculating the phase out, it would apportion their gross income to each spouse based on their share of the couple's earned income.
Thank you. And this bill was originally championed by Representative Davids in the 2017 a tax bill. In fact, when it left the House that year, it actually was refundable. So what this does is it will make the student loan credit refundable, which especially early on in the payment period when these people are young and starting to pay this off, that refundable credit is, and their income is lower, the refundable credit is going to be very beneficial to them. And then also anytime I think we can fix the marriage penalty in any area of our tax law, it's a good thing. So those are kind of the main reasons for that. But this was a program that was championed by Representative Davids. Comments, questions? Yeah. Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's a very minor point, but I really would like to request that everybody who is on the Zoom put up both their first and their last names. I'm sure Stephen is very important, but I don't know who he is, and I wish he would include his last name, and then we're all on level playing field. Thank you, Mr. Rubis. Appreciate it.
Okay. Any other thoughts or comments?
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Davids.
Stephen Rubis is very important.
It's good we know his full name, absolutely.
Yes.
All right. Chair Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I got to my voice before I did my hand there.
That's good.
So I'm just looking for the line on the spreadsheet for that student loan credit. And can somebody just give me that line?
That's fine. I can ask Ms. Templin.
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, that line on the spreadsheet is line 167.
Thank you.
And it has this provision has a general fund cost of $9.3 million in fiscal 22 and 23 and $9.7 million in fiscal 24 and 25.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, members. Thank you, staff. That concludes our agenda for today. As I had mentioned tomorrow, Chair Nelson will have the gavel. As I had mentioned on Friday, we will have MMB Commissioner Showalter in. So Chair Nelson, any thoughts or comments?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe these are good meetings where we actually get to discuss these elements, some that are very similar, some that were not included in one bill or the other. We will do a similar type thing tomorrow. I believe we have five items that will be coming out in the agenda later today that we'll take a look at like this. And again, I do want to thank the research staff having the graph that shows us the provision, where it is on the side-by-side, the different articles that it's in or not are important. And of course, I always like to get the spreadsheet number two, line number two, so we know what that cost is as well. So that's what we will be doing tomorrow. We do know that we are in a sense, we're doing the work that we can at this point. But until we get a global budget target, it's very hard for us to adopt any of these items that cost, that have a fiscal implication. So we are hoping that we do get that global target soon. I would reiterate, though, how helpful it was yesterday, and we believe we'll get some more information tomorrow, to know that Minnesota does not need to be concerned about the clawback or the potential for recoupment of spending, of lowering tax revenue by doing pure conformity with the federal government. So I think that is an important piece. And as we get more information tomorrow, could be very helpful too, as we look to see if some of those conformity pieces can be paid for through some of the other revenue recapture too. So there's more for us to learn, and of course, more that we're waiting on from the governor and the speaker of the House, the majority leader in the Senate. So with that, I do really appreciate all of the work we've done so far and look forward to continued work Thursday and Friday. We'll have to see what happens on the weekend. That's all for right now.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Appreciate your work and House and Senate teams work on all these things. And every day we're getting a little bit more information. Hopefully we're getting a little closer to a global agreement, like as you say, would really aid us in our work. So thank you, everyone. With that, we are adjourned.